This is Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Steve Chiotakis. It's busy these days over at Eat at Joe's. It's a diner right on PCH in the heart of Redondo Beach that's served up breakfast, lunch, and a lively atmosphere for decades. This spot was particularly busy yesterday afternoon because its outdoor dining tables are open. And right now, that's illegal in Los Angeles County.
I couldn't close it. I just couldn't do it to my employees.
Alex Jordan has owned and operated Eat at Joe's the last 20 years.
You know, when we closed in March, and I knew that they were going to get unemployment, $600 a week and all that. So I knew they would be taken care of. That's my most number one concern. But this time, it's not there. And so I didn't have any choice. I had to stay open to them.
Since last week, after Thanksgiving, restaurants in L.A. County haven't been able to serve customers inside or out. But Jordan opened Friday. His decision to stay open and keep his outdoor dining going has made him sort of an internet sensation. It's also an inflection point in L.A. right now over what to do about rising COVID-19 infections and hospitalizations. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb joins me now. He covers the business of Southern California. Hey, Benjamin.
Hey, Jonathan.
So a restaurant owner that's just saying no to local health rules. Benjamin, tell me a little bit more about this place and what it's like.
Absolutely. So Eat at Joe's has been around since the late 1960s. And I think the best way you can describe it, Jonathan, it's really your typical LA beach community diner, right? I mean, it's open until the mid-afternoon. It serves up breakfast and lunch. Right now, there's a huge tent that sits in its parking lot, which is completely covered, and the tables are either distanced or they have this plexiglass between them. And I gotta tell you, this place is loud. There's a community element to it, a social element to the dining experience.
Yeah, a social element. Was the place crowded when you were there? There's not a lot of places to be social these days.
There sure isn't. And when I was there yesterday, the outdoor tables were basically full the entire time. I met one gentleman who was eating there, John Verbeest. He lives nearby, and he says he expects to come to the restaurant every day now for the foreseeable future. He really supports what Alex Jordan is doing.
I give them a lot of credit. They have the guts to stay open. And I think we're going to see more and more of them push the envelope because they're like, look, I have two choices. You can shut me down or I'm going to get shut down on my own because I can't afford the shutdown. So I think a lot of people are going to say, you know what? The hell. And I think I would encourage all of us to be respectful, wear our masks and distancing. I'm not a denier of this or anything like that. But I think it would encourage all of us to really support any of these that open up any way we can. Or we're not going to have a lot of small businesses when all this gets past us in the next 9 to 12 months.
Now, Verbeest says he's not convinced that eating outside is really a big risk. I should also mention, Jonathan, he was eating by himself, and that's what he plans to continue to do for the foreseeable future.
Right. And so, Benjamin, I mean, why is Jordan doing this? Is it a political statement or economic desperation? What is it?
Yeah, it's really both. I mean, he really doesn't want to lay off his employees. He told me that many of them have been with him since the beginning. But the politics are also a major motivator, too. Jonathan, does the French Laundry ring a bell?
I think that's where Governor Gavin Newsom infamously ate dinner last month with some lobbyists indoors. That's in Napa wine country. This was after scolding the rest of us not to do that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I got to tell you, Alex Jordan, he really took that personally.
It made me feel angry. When I saw him at that meal, like it was nothing, after he's preaching all this other stuff, the hypocrisy of it overwhelmed me. It really overwhelmed. And the next day he got on TV and he was like, oh, I'm sorry, I did it. Well, you know what? Not good enough for me.
It's not just not good enough for Alex Jordan. He also has covered the Eat at Joe's sign outside his restaurant with a banner that reads the French Laundry. So a direct dig at the governor.
Right.
Now, Jordan tells me he's not really a big protester, but this was his way of expressing himself. I should also point out, it's not just Newsom that's been taking heat recently. LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl, who voted to shut down outdoor dining just last week, well, she was seen sitting outside at a restaurant in Santa Monica the day before these closures took place, adding to some of the frustration that restaurateurs are experiencing.
Right. I mean, if you think about it, any restaurant could stay open like this. So does LA County have any way to enforce this ban on outdoor dining?
Well, they do. The head of LA County's Department of Public Health is Barbara Ferrer. We've heard her a lot here on KCRW. She has said the first step is warning restaurant owners about their malfeasance, and then there could be fines and possibly revoking a restaurant's permits. Well, if you're wondering if the police are going to come out and shut down a place, the answer is no, they're not, especially in Redondo Beach. Jordan says people have actually called the cops on him.
I spoke to the police. They called me as a courtesy call, which was very nice. And later, several officers came and had lunch here and got food to go. So I'm not.
Did they sit down?
No, they got it to go, but they came to the window. They saw all kinds of people. And we were a little busy then.
You heard him say right there, they came, they saw all kinds of people, but they just let it go. And that's the deal, right? I reached out to the Redondo Police Department about this. I should say they did not respond to repeated requests for comments, but as of now, it looks like they won't be taking any action.
That's interesting. Well, meanwhile, most restaurants are staying closed. You've been out talking to restaurant owners. I'd imagine they're pretty frustrated too, aren't they?
Yeah, I've been all across the Southland talking to restaurant owners the past several weeks, and I can tell you they are pretty conflicted. I mean, they've got to balance the seriousness of the pandemic with also keeping the lights on and their employees paid. It's not easy. The restaurant owners I've met, they feel like they're being unfairly blamed for this current surge in COVID-19 cases. So take Pine Avenue, for example. This is in Long Beach. The city of Long Beach actually shut it down to car traffic earlier in the summer for only outdoor dining. And at the time, I talked to a gentleman named Colin Mitzenmacher. He's a vintner and co-owner of this place called Water's Edge Winery there. He was so worried about his business going out of business. But guess what? With the patio up and running, he was actually able to get back to pre-pandemic levels of business. I went to talk to him yesterday, and he tells me now the place is just a ghost town.
We immediately did everything we could to do outdoor dining. A lot of my neighbors put a lot of money into these parklets, getting out onto the street. And I feel for them most of all because they now have parklets sitting there completely empty. So I tried to do little things to try and make this thing work. And then as soon as you start to make it work, they turn around and say no again.
So you can hear the frustration, Jonathan, in his voice. Health officials have said that outdoor dining has contributed to this current uptick in positive COVID-19 cases. It is, after all, one of the only places where, until recently, you could sit unmasked with other people. But restaurant owners like Mitzenmacher, they just don't buy it. Not to mention this one last point, Jonathan. In a city like Long Beach, all you got to do is drive 6.5 miles down PCH, and guess what? You're in Orange County in Seal Beach, where outdoor dining is alive and well, and that has contributed to this feeling of being singled out by LA restaurateurs and how arbitrary all this might seem to them.
All right, well, the outdoor dining ban in LA lasts 3 weeks, and that could change as we approach the holidays. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb, keeping tabs on the business of Southern California. Thanks, Ben.
You're welcome, Jonathan.
And a quick follow-up, we just got word from the Redondo Police. Officer Andrew Lewis says that his department is keeping a log of restaurants that are in violation of the health order, but he did confirm they are not doing any enforcement at this time. This is Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian in for Steve Chiatakis. And now to the rose ceremony.
Hannah, gentlemen, this is the final rose tonight. When you're ready.
Tonight, the latest episode of ABC's The Bachelorette will air. The season's only just gotten underway, but it's been marked by historic firsts. COVID postponed production, then there was a bachelorette switcheroo, and now the suitors are courting a biracial bachelorette. She's both Black and Mexican. Orange County native Tayshia Adams is the franchise's second Black lead. To put that in perspective, there have been 40 seasons over the past 18 years. On the heels of the summer's protests, ABC, the network behind The Bachelor, and other primetime networks, pledged solidarity with Black Lives Matter and to cast more people of color. And this bachelorette season is the most diverse it's ever been. But can diversity issues and equity issues be fixed with recasting? Or is there anything else that reality TV can do to look more like the people watching? Ricardo Handy is a film editor. He's now editing the latest season of Love Island. Hey, Ricardo, thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. Well, as I mentioned, there'll be a new episode of The Bachelorette tonight. And I'm curious, when you first heard that Tayshia Adams was the new lead, were you hopeful about that casting choice?
You know, I always root for, you know, anyone trying to put diversity in their filming or in their shows. But, you know, I always take a wait and see approach because, you know, sometimes the same team behind the scenes is still doing the show. And so the same perspectives a lot are shown.
Right. I mean, do you think that just casting more diverse players in Big Brother and The Bachelor is helping to fix this big question of equity issues going on in reality TV?
I think equity is less of a picture, right? Like less of an appearance than and more about the inner workings behind the scenes and the intention behind it. Like, is your intention to tell more diverse stories or just appear to have more diverse people with the same exact show you had last year?
Right. Right. I mean, is part of your fear that, you know, there's just been so much attention on this issue that we may see this for a season or two and then it'll just go back to normal?
I mean, that's happens all the time. Like, that's the whole like concept of moral licensing, right? Like you do the thing that people have been asking you to do one time just to kind of appease people. And then you move on. I don't think that's what's going on here. I think people are genuinely trying. I just think that a lot of it requires, you know, sometimes different decision makers in the mix, right? Not necessarily replacing everyone, but having multiple voices helping with decision making across the board. I happen to know that they were also trying to look for Black editors as well, and it was kind of, you know, this rush, and it was an afterthought. And I think that's the problem with a lot of these decisions. It's an afterthought. A lot of the problems with a lot of these dating shows is you have people casting, you know, the quintessential all-American like trope, you know, as the person that people desire, you know, that this woman's going to desire. So then you have to cast a woman that actually likes that kind of man, right? However, there's all different kind of diverse people from all different kind of diverse backgrounds that are getting together in different relationship dynamics and makeups. And so, you know, you'll find a lot of times you have the token Black girl on one of these dating shows, and there's no men for her to match with because they all are looking for a blonde woman, right? Or they're all looking for, you know, a certain kind of guy, you know, that all-American guy. And so those are the couples that end up finding each other on these shows a lot of times instead of, you know, there being more of a diversity of people getting together.
And diversity in the sense of also socioeconomic diversity or geographic diversity. I mean, things that create just a more realistic picture of what a person is, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you think about in the real dating world, you know, people are attracted to different things. You know, you definitely want people from different backgrounds, not just people from, you know, the suburbs, right? The Orange Counties of the world, right? But people from, you know, the urban centers of the world and the rural areas and people that have had, you know, I grew up in Germany, right? So, you know, if I was on a show like that, I would want someone with some international flavor too. I mean, I talk to folks all the time that are making these kind of decisions. And a lot of times the go-to is, you know, what's worked before, right? What's worked in the past. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of innovation on, you know, kind of building everything from the ground up with diversity in mind.
And there is, I suppose, a fear that if you do present a real America or a real full picture of someone, that an audience or advertisers just may not be interested in that?
I think that's a falsehood. I think that it's been disproven every time it's been shown. People like to see real things. People like to feel like something's authentic, especially now. If your audience feels like it's fake, they tune out. A lot of these shows, like Big Brother, Bachelor, and Bachelorette, they're just like clearly staples in people's viewing patterns. that there are certain people that are going to watch it every season. And honestly, I think that it's television and films have the opportunity to innovate in these areas where no one else will and be pioneers and really change the conversation in a country. It happens all the time on social media, and television isn't as brave.
Yeah. You know, we've been talking about casting directors and the people making the decisions about who gets on or off the television screen. But do you think, in terms of the executive producers, people that have a lot of weight in the industry, that we may see more people of color entering those positions as well, and therefore creating just more space in this environment that we're talking about?
I'm hopeful that that will happen. I do think that generally people kind of think about hiring a diverse showrunner, but a lot of times the studios and the networks are doing business with the same production companies. And so if the production company owner and the network aren't necessarily on the same page about the diversity being a priority, then it won't happen. Because no matter what showrunner they kind of hire as, again, a token, I mean, I've been hired or called for shows kind of after everything's been ideated because they need a black showrunner. Like that call happens all the time. And it's like, okay, well, if you wouldn't have put your whole team together, you wouldn't have done all this development and made all these castings and all these plans if diversity was a priority for you, even though you know you were telling a black story or a Latino story from the beginning. You know, that is an afterthought because a network or someone raised their hand and said, hey, guys, this is a problem. You know what I mean? And that's generally how it happens. So I think what it's going to require is studios and production company owners taking charge and saying, this is important to me. And when I develop, when I create, when I partner with people, when I cast, I'm going to make my shows look like what America looks like. Because people forget, you know, this country is on its way to being majority people of color very soon. And, you know, that's just the reality of it. And so a lot of people, a lot of bigger studios, publicly traded companies like Disney, they're already on it. They're already switching up a lot of different of their content, you know, stories they're telling. And I think that the smaller companies and the networks that kind of pander to the general market, you know, will be slower to catch up, but eventually everybody's going to need to get on the same page that, you know, our television, our stories need to reflect the people in this country.
Well, I know you just wrapped production for a new campaign of Greenwood. You worked with an all-black crew and an all-black cast. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you for asking. My company, Sunwise Media, you know, we also do, you know, television and commercials and things like that. And Greenwood, commercial we just did was starring Jesse Williams. It's a bank that Killer Mike has been kind of the founding, one of the founding fathers of, and really kind of out there sharing with the world about how important it is to kind of spend money and keep our money in our communities so we can have power to make the kind of decisions we're talking about. And that one of the ways we were showing that was, you know, we shot the show, we shot the commercial at Issa Rae's coffee shop, Hilltop in Inglewood, and we also hired an all-black crew, some of them who live in Inglewood, live in that community. So that money that we generated, that money that we brought to the community can stay reinvested into that community and recycled in that community. And I think that's really what we have to do more of to really prop up, you know, not only our businesses, but our individuals in our communities that come from diverse backgrounds, that come from, you know, these underserved communities. We have to put our money where our mouth is and not just kind of tokenize, you know, when we need to look good.
Ricardo Handy is an editor, producer, production executive, and owner of Sunwise Media. We appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Onward with Greater LA. I'm Jonathan Bastian in for Steve Chiatakis. Now a little locally national politics. That's the sound of protesters outside Getty House, the LA mayor's residence. They've been there every morning for more than a week. They're out there because President-elect Joe Biden is reportedly considering Mayor Garcetti for the position of transportation secretary. The protesters say Garcetti has done a bad job as mayor, and they want to block his appointment. But what are the mayor's qualifications for a position heading up the National Transportation Agency? And what might his appointment mean for LA? Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor at Curbed and a regular contributor here at Greater LA. Hey, Alyssa.
Hey, Jonathan.
As someone closely following the latest news in the world of transportation, what's your reaction to Garcetti's name being floated around for this position?
I was honestly a little surprised. I mean, It's not surprising that he'd be considered for a cabinet position. He was the co-chair of Biden's campaign. Usually those people are given roles in the administration. But it really was this question about where he would fit in. But then when the transportation transition team was announced, we found out the team was being headed by Phil Washington, who is CEO of Metro here in LA. And that seemed to be a very strong signal for a Garcetti pick.
And what's made Garcetti so divisive? I mean, we just heard some sound there of protesters outside his house. I mean, they're trying to stop this appointment and keep him here in L.A. so he doesn't go national, right?
Yes, there have been, on some days, there's been hundreds of people outside of his residence each morning at 9 a.m. trying to wake him up. They were out there again this morning, and you can watch these actions. They're all streamed live by Black Lives Matter LA, which is leading this action along with many other groups, or by following this hashtag Block Garcetti, which is what they're trying to do. They're trying to block his appointment, and organizers say they won't stop until he confirms that he's not going to D.C., which hasn't happened yet.
Right. We'll see how that goes. But I mean, what has Garcetti done to deserve this position? In your opinion, has the guy done much for transportation in L.A.?
Well, if you read all these stories about who is being floated for these cabinet positions, Garcetti is always listed under Transportation Secretary. And all the stories mention his involvement in the passing of Measure M, which is this countywide ballot measure that we approved in 2016 that increased our sales tax to pay for these major transit projects. And it's true, Measure M did allow LA to build these big transportation infrastructure faster than any other part of the U.S. And Garcetti sits on the Metro board. He's the chair, and he's overseen many of the decisions about how the money's been spent. But I think how that money has been spent is one of the major concerns of the protesters, who I think have made a very good case that Garcetti's transportation agenda has left people behind. You know, if you look at what LA has built, it's been these huge rail projects, mostly in wealthy and wider neighborhoods over the last few years. At the same time, LA has basically ignored its bus riders. Ridership has plummeted. You've seen no attempt to improve how most transit users get around the city. We still have horrible bus shelters. We have streets with no shade, bad sidewalks. And then if you look at other transportation initiatives like Vision Zero, this is the mayor's plan to eliminate traffic deaths by 2025. Traffic deaths have actually gone up over the last few years. And this is also a racial justice issue, as we know that people who are Black and brown are much more likely to die walking and biking. I also talked to one organizer who pointed out that many of the people protesting are from climate and environmental justice groups who are angry that LA's transportation emissions keep going up, LA's air quality keeps getting worse, and those negative impacts are going to fall disproportionately on Black and brown communities as well.
Right. Now, if Garcetti were to land this job, and even if he doesn't, I mean, what would he or the eventual head of the U.S. Department of Transportation have to deal with? What problems are they inheriting or facing?
I think for an incoming transportation secretary, the mandate really does come down to emissions right now, how to quickly electrify our vehicles and shift the money that we're spending, you know, billions of dollars on highways into things like lower emission travel, walking, biking, buses, trains, make it easier or cheaper and safer for everyone to get around. But transportation is really in need of an exceptionally strong federal leader at this particular moment, because public transit particularly is in crisis. Because of the pandemic nationwide. And we haven't seen any kind of federal bailout for trains and buses. And many systems are being forced to make major service cuts, including here in LA. So transit could literally die in this country. And we need somebody who really knows how to save it.
So if he did get the job, could that be a good thing for LA? I mean, a lot of transportation projects depend on federal funding.
Right. And we have seen during, you know, this past administration, the Trump administration, this real resistance to give us the money for things like the Purple Line extension, which is, you know, our major subway project. You saw a lot of withholding of those types of funds, particularly around active transportation, bus service even. You know, we aren't seeing that kind of bailout currently from this administration. So Yes, in a way, if he did go, if Mr. Garcetti did go to Washington, I think we would have a strong advocate in the administration that might be able to get not just LA, but all American cities the right kind of transportation funding that they do need.
Alyssa Walker is a columnist at Curbed and a regular contributor here at Greater LA. Alyssa, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's all we got for tonight. Tomorrow, thousands of inmates have been released from prisons and jails because of COVID. Are they getting the support they need on the outside? We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA, where you can hear all our stories and subscribe to the podcast as well. Once again, that's kcrw.com/greaterLA. Big thanks to our team, including Christian Bordahl, Jenna Cagle, Angel Carreras, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Mario Diaz, Mario Saavedra, Mike Stark, and Amy Taw. I'm Jonathan Bastian, sitting in for Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night.